The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, once again, we turn to the Trumpet magazine to make sense of what's happening in this ever chaotic and dangerous world. My father had a piece just 2 years ago, The Times of the Gentiles. What are the times of the Gentiles, he asked. And in that article, he took us through Christ's prophecy there in Luke 21 about the times of the Gentiles being fulfilled. These times are not yet fully realized, he said. And then to quote him, he said, however, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. He said, events taking place in Ukraine with Russia, along with those in the Middle East, and Iran have everything to do with this prophecy, what we see happening in Ukraine, with Russia, in Iran. Then you think about, the subjects that we discussed yesterday on the program, all of these dictatorships around the world aligning themselves together against the United States. The times of the Gentiles, the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. Brett Stevens had a piece just today or yesterday on the new Dictators Club. And he says in his subtitle, an echo of the 1930s in the budding alliance of Russia, Iran, Turkey, and China. It adds Turkey and China to the mix. We talked about China to some extent yesterday. In fact, we've written a lot on all of these nations. And what we see happening in the world today, it has everything to do with this prophecy from Jesus Christ. Luke 21, the times of the Gentiles. It says in verse 24, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword. This is Luke 21. They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And so we can look at the world today and see a United States superpower that's in retreat, full-scale retreat. And then the rise, the emergence, the ascendance of all these other nations, many of them even aligning together against the U.S., Brett Stevens said in his piece, Iran and Russia are not natural allies, even if they have a common client in Damascus. Iranians have bitter memories of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s, and the Kremlin has never been fond of Islamists, even of the Shiite variety. But what tipped the scales in favor of a joint operation was a shared desire to humiliate the U.S. and to kick it out of the Middle East. And so they have a common enemy. And now they have this joint operation. These two nations that aren't natural allies by any means. In fact, there's some bitter memories between the two. They have different ambitions. Oftentimes they can't get along with each other. But they've found a common cause that they can rally around, and it has to do with defeating and humiliating the United States of America. Stevens, in his piece, he quotes the Ayatollah from a meeting that he had with Vladimir Putin in November of 2015. This was not quite a year ago. But the Supreme Leader says America's long-term scheme for the region is detrimental to all nations and countries, particularly Iran and Russia. And it should be thwarted through vigilance and closer interaction. That's what he said in November, just a month and a half or so before the details on the nuclear deal were finalized. Again, we pointed this out yesterday, all of these nefarious dealings going on with Iran and Russia, even before the nuke deal was finalized. Here he refers to America's scheme for the region and how it's detrimental to all nations. All nations. You talk about acting in bad faith. And yet some of these nations, like Iran, it has the audacity to criticize the United States, saying that it's the United States that's not holding up its end of the bargain. It's Iran that's threatening to walk away, not the U.S. The U.S. is doing everything that it can to plead for Iran to stay with it, to stay with the deal. This is part of President Obama's legacy. But here is this alliance. Russian jets just last week taking off from a base there in Iran. We pointed this out yesterday, and evidently since then the Iranians have, well, they didn't take too kindly to just how much Russia was bragging about this, taking off from those Iranian air bases. And one of the Iranian spokespeople said that it was just a refueling operation, basically, and that they're not opening a military base in Iran. So they've come out. They didn't like the way Russia announced it publicly last week. Like Brett Stevens says, I mean, they're not natural allies. But what tipped the scales in favor of a joint operation was a shared desire to humiliate the United States and to kick it out of the Middle East. That's what we're seeing happen, and that's why these unlikely allies are joining forces. These are alarming developments. Or at least they should be. They should be alarming. Here, Russia, instead of being over 1,000 miles away and sending its jets down to Syria, well, it's just a few hundred miles away if it can start using this base in Iran. Well, Stevens brings out in his piece, you have Russia, you have Iran, then there's China. It says here, Mr. Putin's relations with Beijing haven't always been smooth. China is adept at stealing Russian military technology as it is at hacking U.S. secrets, and the Russians don't appreciate being treated as junior partners. But the drills in the South China Sea are another reminder that the Kremlin's overriding foreign policy goal is to hobble and diminish the United States. It's a goal that Beijing appears to share. And so here are these two great powers, these two world powers. China's now building a base, as we covered yesterday, in Djibouti. And it's building all of these bases in the South China Sea. Tens of thousands of acres. Here they are, oftentimes picking at each other, squabbling with one another, fighting against each other, and yet coming together. Coming together with this overriding foreign policy goal to hobble and diminish the United States. Well, the Bible speaks of this Asian alliance, the kings of the East, the Russians and the Chinese coming together. And you think about the union to come out of the heart of Europe. Here again, the Bible describes that as being an unsteady mixture of iron and clay. Lots of differences, lots of squabbles, but one overriding foreign policy goal. That's what we see. It keeps playing out. Stevens writes, President Obama and his advisors continue to insist that the world has never been better, safer, happier place than under their benign stewardship, meaning they no longer even register the continuous embarrassments of their foreign policy. These aren't embarrassing developments. These aren't anything to be ashamed of. what's happening with Russia going on the rampage, with the Ayatollah meeting with Putin, saying America's the real enemy, the danger for all the nations of the world. These aren't foreign policy failures. Not the way this administration looks at it. Stephen says here, the administration has become the Black Knight from the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, comically indifferent to his own dismemberment. Just carrying on, no alarm bells going off. Just carrying on as if we're not wounded. These aren't setbacks. These aren't failures. Stevens, by the way, refers to this piece at Vox.com. It echoes some of the sound bites that we've played for you over the years, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years. You know the ones about the White House spokesman saying that the world is more tranquil than ever before, that if you had a choice to be born in any era, the president has said, and his surrogates as well, this would be it. What a time to be born. A world of so much peace and prosperity and happiness. This Vox.com piece is titled, Think the World is on Fire? Obama's National Security Advisor says things are better than ever. You think the world is burning? They don't. They think it's better than ever. It says here, amidst all of this activity and cooperation among America's enemies, the Obama administration continues to act as if nothing is going wrong. In fact, it insists that everything is getting better. And it quotes Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, talking about improvement in world poverty, how conflict between states is less than it's ever been. And of course, the explosion in technology giving us extraordinary opportunities. And then she compares it. Well, look at the way it was with World War I or World War II. Look at the mass casualties there, even in Vietnam. And compare it to today. And so they continue on. Even as the forces of this world are mobilizing, even as they're coming together, Russia together with China, and then soon the 10 nations out of Europe, the iron and clay mix, and of course the King of the South is already firmly in place, as I covered yesterday. Who came out on top on the Iran nuke deal? It's the Ayatollah. He's stronger than ever. Stronger than ever. And now it's the Russians and the Iranians calling the shots in the Middle East. Everyone can see that. And yet the administration in Washington, D.C., the White House, well, it looks at this world and says, you know what? It's better than it's ever been. You think the world's on fire? It's actually getting better and better. My father wrote back in 2009, this was in response to that Cairo speech that the president gave early on in his presidency. My father said, we're witnessing a reenactment of the 1930s between Chamberlain and Hitler. Chamberlain tried to negotiate his way to peace as Hitler gobbled up Europe. World War II was almost lost before the West mustered the will to fight. It says here, according to Daniel's prophecy, America will not even be on the scene when this military clash occurs. That's speaking of the prophecy in Daniel 11:40. He writes, my father does, that should alarm America as well as Britain and the Jewish nation. It means that America is totally absent because of its economic collapse and lack of will to use its military power. We're already seeing that, but there's more economic ruin to come. And to be sure, we haven't yet gotten to the point of mass casualties like we witnessed in World War II. But when you hear all of these spokespeople coming forward saying the world, you know what, the world is better than it's ever been and it just keeps getting better and better. You remember those prophecies like the one in Luke 21 about the times of the Gentiles because they are rising, these Gentile powers. And you remember other prophecies as well, like 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 2 says, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. It's coming as a thief in the night when everyone's sleeping. Everyone thinks it's peaceful. Everyone thinks it's secure. It's safe. And then verse 3, for when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. I mean, there was a period coming out of World War I, for sure, where mankind thought, well, we learned our lesson. There never will be another war like that one. That was the Great War. But now we've got, I mean, everyone's coming together in this new era of globalism. And how could we ever make such a serious mistake again? Well, and then World War II happened. Like my father said in that Times of the Gentile article, you can see that we're on the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. Okay, the catastrophic storm hasn't yet hit. But what we're seeing are the outer edges. When they say peace and safety, sudden destruction is coming. Another translation says catastrophe will sweep down upon them as suddenly and inescapably as birth pangs to a pregnant woman. All this happens when? Well, when the leaders, the diplomats, are out there saying peace and security. It's better now than ever. It's safer now than it's ever been. It's more tranquil. Verse 4, Paul says, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. See, God's people, they know better. They know better. They look to the Bible. They're studying thetrumpet.com, the Trumpet magazine. They understand world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. They see, you brethren, you're not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. God's truth in abundance. It's been made available to this church. And God's people know. They know the times in which we're living. They know that it's high time to awake out of sleep, as Paul wrote elsewhere. Verse 5 says, you are all the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. No, we're not. We are children of the light. We're made children of God through Christ. Through Christ. Children of the light, as it says here. Therefore, let us not sleep, as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Peter said, watch unto prayer. Jesus said, watch and pray always. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 15, awake to righteousness and sin not. Watch, wake up, be spiritually alert. We've got to keep ourselves awake spiritually, otherwise we go to sleep. And we're totally unaware of the dangers that are gathering. The gathering storm, this catastrophic storm that's just now approaching. And yet so many, as these verses bring out, they're spiritually drunk on the wrong teachings and cares of this world. But you that are children of light, be sober-minded in all of your thoughts. Be sober-minded and watch, it says. Watch and be sober. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us your comments as the week unfolds. Send those messages, those emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
With some of the messages and studies that I've gotten into this past summer, I have seen a reoccurring theme with quite a few of them. And you'll recall some of them. I've brought it up even on the radio, the impact that Wolfgang Mozart's father had on his upbringing and his love and appreciation for music, fine music, classical music, and his expertise. We've also talked of late about John Quincy Adams, the son of America's second president, John Adams, and just how involved John Adams was in the upbringing of his son. And that son went on to become one of the best educated presidents in U.S. history. Here in Stratford, while we had our youth camp going on a couple weeks back, we visited Shakespeare's birthplace. A few days after that, I was able to go to where Shakespeare went to school. I saw that with my wife and my family. And while I didn't do as much reading this summer on Shakespeare's father, I'm not even sure how much is there, but based upon these tours that we took, he certainly seemed to be an upstanding member of the community here, and no doubt had a strong impact on little William's upbringing. In the Bible, of course, my father's talked earlier in the summer about Abraham, the great patriarch Abraham, and the impact that he had on culture, fine culture, in Austria, and other nations too that were impacted by Abraham, Father Abraham's influence, Egypt, Assyria, and of course, Israel. And then you look at God the Father himself, and how that the whole gospel that Jesus Christ brought to this earth revolved around the Father. It says in John 1 and verse 18 that Jesus came to declare the Father. That's a message you don't hear in the world of traditional Christianity. They don't talk about the Father. They make Jesus Christ, the Son, the central figure of their gospel, their false gospel. But that's not what Jesus Christ came to do. He put the emphasis where it belonged, on the Father, the head of the family. Now, when you look at the amount of time and all the resources and the energy and the love that God's true church puts into the family, of late, we've, of course, talked about our many youth programs, how that God's work reaches out to our young people, our children, with these many youth programs, with the summer camps, with a grade school, an academy, and a college now with two campuses. if you visit one of the congregations in God's true church, in many of them, you're going to see a lot of young, happy faces. Not all of them. Some congregations, of course, are a little bit older. But we have a lot of young people in this church, in this work, that are just like the adults, listening to messages. Some of them listening to these programs on KPCG, helping contribute to the well-being of their families, their congregations, attending school, playing intramural sports, helping with cleanup, involved in PYC, pursuing special hobbies, singing, dancing, participating in the church festivals, the church activities. They're being taught how to live God's wonderful way of life. And as I covered on the program we recorded last week, it'll play this weekend here in the UK. In all of these programs, I mean, you do see the world tomorrow. Today, you see it right now. You see the world tomorrow in embryo. Think about the world of tomorrow and how it's going to be set up and established. It's going to be built right around the family, family living. And each individual family will revolve around the role of the father, the primary educator of these youths that I mentioned. The church can certainly reinforce and support what's happening in the home. But the father is the central figure of a godly home. Now, that's a message, obviously, that's not very popular today. In fact, the role of the father is attacked from every direction. It's undermined by the God of this world, who is broadcasting his attitudes of self-centeredness, vanity, and rebellion to authority, including fatherly authority. You see evidence of the devil's influence everywhere that you look. You can't miss it. If your eyes are open to the truth, you can't miss it. I'm going to be taping a program, hopefully this afternoon, on the seventh and final era of God's church, discussed in Revelation chapter 3, the last several verses of that chapter, the Laodicean era. And one of the central lessons that you can learn about God's church, God's little flock scattered throughout the centuries, is that if it did have a spurt of growth and great power, that after the second and third generation, what usually set in or what usually happened was that the majority or most fell away from the church, the truth. In Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong's old correspondence course, Lesson 51, it says, in era after era of God's church, it is a repeated fact that after a few generations, the local congregations are no longer generally composed of truly converted brethren, but of unconverted children and half-hearted believers, of whom many go astray into error. Time after time, time and again. That, as it says there, after a few generations, an era or a church that started out on fire for God, on fire for obeying his laws, for living his way of life. Well, over time, the young ones would grow up and replace their parents, and they'd end up lacking the same fire and zeal, spiritually speaking. And so it's a battle, isn't it? It's a real battle. It's a weighty responsibility on the shoulders of that God-fearing father to bring fire and life, spiritually speaking, into the lives of his children. Notice a prophecy here in Isaiah 3. It's one we read often. But it says here, this is talking about what would persist in these latter days. Verse 4, and I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. And the child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. As you look around society in the West today, do you see that? That disrespect and dishonor coming from the younger generation? God says right here that babes shall rule over them. They're the ones in charge. God has prophesied this. And today it's so common. I mean, well, we just look at it and think it's normal. Children or young people, teenagers running the show. This is the world that Jesus prayed for us to come out of. And we need God's help and guidance and direction to do that. We need God's perspective. We need to bring God into our households, into our families, into our marriages. We need to make God the Father, the central figure of our home, of our family life. In the world, of course, it's just the opposite. It's upside down. Verse 12 says, as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. Children oppress, women rule, and well, there's no mention of fathers whatsoever in that verse. But what's interesting, whether you look at verses 4 and 5, they're about children ruling. I think it says it in verse 4. And then verse 12, it says women rule. They're ruling, you see. They're ruling. And this is the environment that so many young people grow up in today. It's not a godly home where the father's ruling. It's an upside-down home. Don't even talk to us about the father ruling. I mean, that's old school. That's chauvinist. But the children ruling, that's okay. Women ruling, that's okay. That's the world of today. In the old child-rearing booklet from years ago, this was produced by the Worldwide Church of God, it says here quite simply, any child reared in an upside-down home is going to develop into an upside-down child. Now, God is merciful, and God can lead us out of that upside-down world. We can't come out of it if we've been brought up in that environment. But the simple fact remains, I mean, if you're growing up in an upside-down home, chances are you're going to have some upside-down thinking. And so the objective for true Christians, for fathers, for mothers, for children in a godly family, is to set things right side up, to arrange it or organize the family based upon the biblical model or pattern. Families with God as the central figure, with Jesus Christ providing direction, with a human father submitting to Jesus Christ as his head, and Jesus Christ declaring the Father above him. And the father, together with the help of a loving, supportive mother, exercising godly authority over submissive children, ruling their children well. Now, that's the only way to have a happy, joyful, productive, growing family. It's the only way, and man has tried every other way imaginable. But this is the way. Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1985, the very foundation of any stable civilization is a solid family structure. It says here, today's civilization, with its foundation disintegrating, is itself on the way out. That's the article he titled, Where This Breakdown in Family Life is Taking Us. the foundation of civilization, is the solid family structure. And so what happens when that structure begins to deteriorate, when it begins to fall apart? As the family goes, so goes the nation. And the same is true of families in the true church of God, the spiritual nation of God's church. As the family goes, so goes the nation. In that article, Mr. Armstrong continued, God is a kingdom. That is the supreme divine family that rules the universe. The whole gospel, which Jesus Christ brought from God for mankind, is the good news of the coming kingdom of God. This is the gospel message that Jesus brought from God the Father. And then he arrived, as John 1 brings out, and he said, I'm here to declare the Father. He wasn't embarrassed to preach the truth of the Bible, to preach the truth about the Father's role, the truth about the kingdom of God, the true gospel that Jesus proclaimed. This article, Mr. Armstrong says here, and the united, closely knit together family of Christians, the church, will, at the coming of Christ and the time of the resurrection, become the kingdom of God. He said, finally, the kingdom of God starts with a family relationship. First, the physical human families. Second, the one compacted together church. And then finally, when the church is changed to immortality, the God family, which is the kingdom of God. You see, that's why, as I was saying on that program we taped last week, that the world tomorrow, that kingdom, I mean, it's already here in embryo. It's here in God's true church. It's a small mustard seed beginning. But it's here. This is what we're building. It's what we're building. And so as true Christians, we can't think that, well, you know, I've got my problems and issues today, and obviously my family is not as functional as it should be based upon the pattern as it's spelled out in the Bible, but I can always correct those wrongs in the kingdom, or when I'm in God's family, then it'll be perfect. Then I'll be perfect. God says that's what we're here learning today. That's what we're here to do right now. If God's opened our minds to the truth, if we've come out of this world, this upside-down world, we're here to, as it says in Hebrews 10, to live a new and different way, a living way. Notice over in 1 Timothy 3, some really great scriptures here regarding the organization of God's church, the leadership in God's church today. 1 Timothy chapter 3, this is a well-known passage for students of the Bible who know that this is about the outline, or the qualifications rather, of a minister, a leader, a teacher in the church. And of course it's directly applied to those who would be in the ministry, but certainly there are principles here that apply to all of us as Christians. Verse 2, this is 1 Timothy 3, it says, a bishop or a minister then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, but not covetous. And it says in verse 4, one that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. This is New Testament teaching. Paul wasn't concerned about, well, how can I word this to be just absolutely politically correct? How could I word this in a way that wouldn't offend someone? He says here, a leading man in the church needs to rule well his own house. There's that word rule again. And this is from the New Testament now. Keep that in mind. Isaiah 3 talks about children ruling and women ruling, and it's describing an upside-down society. And yet here, the instruction that Paul gives to Timothy is that within the church, for it to be a leading family, you want to make sure that a minister is ruling well his own house. That's one of the qualities of character of a leading man in God's church. The emphasis there is on ruling. I mean, it could have been on a number of other things. He says in verses 2 and 3 what to, many of the things that he should be avoiding, and others like being of good behavior, given to hospitality, and then one that rules. He doesn't focus on one who provides. I mean, if it would have said that, it still would have been a good admonition. He doesn't say here one that's out there just spending a lot of time with his family or teaching his family regularly through Bible studies and such or making sacrifices for the family. I mean, all of that's important. But the all-encompassing quality of character that you're to look for is how well does he rule the home? Does he rule the family the way Jesus Christ rules the church? That's the main goal of any true Christian father. And it comes right out of the Bible. This is God-inspired instruction. God says that a Christian father must rule the home or the family well and bring the children in subjection. They're under authority, in other words. That's 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4. And then verse 5, it continues, "For if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" I mean, if you can't lead your family, how are you going to be able to take on responsibility to lead others? That's pretty plain teaching. And so what does it mean to rule the family well? Is it talking about ruling it like the tyrants or the dictators that are heading up Russia or Iran or China or North Korea or Turkey? It's talking about ruling the way Jesus Christ rules. Leading in love and sacrifice, unselfishness, all of those things. But rule, I mean, with rule, you certainly understand that there's authority there as well, that you have to administer God's family government, that those little ones, those children, have to be brought in subjection to your authority, your position. That's just right out of the Bible, 1 Timothy 3. That shouldn't sound strange. Not if you're a student of the Bible. But of course, you look then at the world today under the influence of the devil. And any thought of bringing children in subjection or developing any kind of restraint in our young people, well, that's just seen as something that's totally oppressive and evil, all wrong. The average parent today feels like it's his or her duty to remove as many restraints as possible from their children's lives. That's the way most parents think. But these supposedly free, unrestrained children are growing up to be miserable, or as we read yesterday, depressed. Or they're becoming a burden to society. Some of them very violent. Children need restraint. It used to be that parents understood this. They need it. They need a proper amount, that they need the right kind and amount of restraint for their own good, for their own protection, for their own development and growth, for their education, for their future. You think about putting a little baby in a car seat and then strapping it in. I mean, that's physically speaking, that's a lot of restraint. Why do you need it? Why not just throw the car seat out the window and let the baby just roam around the back seat, climb over the front, maybe get up on the dashboard while you're driving down the road 60, 70 miles an hour? Is that good for the baby? Unrestrained behavior. Let's remove all restraint. Well, we still have enough sense in Western society today to where if you didn't restrain your baby in that car seat, well, you may well go to jail if you get into an accident. And yet, how many people, when those little ones get a little bit older, how many parents make it their objective to remove as many restraints as possible and to just let them go? To just let them, as Mr. Armstrong said years ago, put up the sails and drift away. Let me show you what it says over in 1 Kings 1. Pretty amazing example here with one of King David's sons. King David, of course, was a man after God's own heart, but he also was a flawed human being that really had to come to master repentance. And he did do that before it was all said and done, that's for sure. But there is cause and effect, and those mistakes that he made earlier in his life, well, the effects of that, it came back on him. 1 Kings and chapter 1, it says here in verse 5, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself. Uh-oh, here comes the son, exalting himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots. So this is a grown man now, but still the son of David, but now fully grown. And he thought, you know what? I should be king now. My father's getting older. He can't carry on with these same responsibilities. This is something that a young man should do. So he prepared his chariots, his horsemen, 50 men to run before him. Then verse 6 it says, and his father had not displeased him at any time, saying, what or why have you done so? That's the start of verse 6. The New King James Version of that verse says this, and his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, why have you done so? In other words, his father never once said, what are you doing? No, you can't do that. Here's this grown son who exalted himself, who said, I'll be king. And then God inspired the next verse to record why this was happening, because David never restrained him. Moffat translates that first part of verse 6 as his father had never checked him all his life by asking what he meant by his conduct. David never said no. David never challenged his son. David never restrained his behavior. Now, verse 6 also says that Adonijah was a goodly man. I mean, David may have seen the good traits in this son. He may have been impressive looking. He may have had a lot of charisma. He may have been able to wow people with his abilities, with his talents. But he was like any other son or daughter. They need to be restrained in a loving and godly way, and yet firm way. They need to be restrained. What does it say in Proverbs 22 and verse 6? Train up that child in the way they should go. Train them up. Show them the way. Give them some boundaries. Don't neglect him. Don't coddle him along. Don't remove all restraint. Train him up. Train him up in the way that he should go. That's Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Look at it on your own time. Our children need to be restrained. They aren't born knowing right from wrong. They need to be taught. And furthermore, they're not immune from evil influences. Your children need you. They need you to help you to understand the truth, to help you. They need your help, rather, to show you where those evil influences are creeping into their thinking. Now, if we don't do that as our job, as parents, then chances are our children are going to be a lot more likely to end up with the same spirit of rebellion and hostility as several of David's own sons did. You see, we've got to train them up in the way that they should go, or to add what we were discussing quite often at this latest youth camp. We're teaching them, we're training them, we're raising them to be kings, to be princes and princesses. Psalm 45. And so they need instruction. There's plenty of examples in the Bible, not just with Adonijah, but you can look at the examples in 1 Samuel 2 with Hophni and Phinehas, sons of Belial, as they're called there in the Scriptures. Worthless sons. Eli didn't restrain these sons of his. He never kept them in check. And that passage in 1 Samuel 2 also brings that out. I'll just leave it to you to go and study it. But what a world our children are growing up in. They need a father. They need a father. In Malachi 1 and verse 6, it says, "A son honors his father, and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where is my honor?" That's God talking about his wayward people in the seventh and final era of God's church, the Laodiceans, who stopped honoring the Father, who rebelled against the Father, and then they fell away from the truth. We've got to bring the Father into the center of our family life. Herbert Armstrong was like a father figure, certainly my father as the physical head of this church today. It's the same thing. There's that principle, that role. It's everywhere that you look in God's church, in God's work. And it's modeled right after the example of Jesus Christ, who said in John 8, I'm striving in all things to please the Father. Everything I want to do here is to just reflect His glory, to carry out His will, to finish His work, and to declare Him, to declare His position, the centrality of His role. He honored the Father. Jesus Christ did. My father wrote in an article years ago talking about the true church, and he said, wherever that church is, they are honoring the Father, the lawgiver, the government giver. As we will see, he writes, the main focus of all that government is to honor the Father. This all revolves around honoring the Father. It's the God family vision. Look then on your own time at the way the book of Malachi concludes, Malachi 4 verses 5 and 6. Look at the emphasis at the start of Malachi, as we read in Malachi 1, 6, and then how it ends. That one coming in the spirit and power of Elijah, turning the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. That's why God's work and church grows and prospers, because of the centrality of the Father's role. That's a role that we've got to really magnify in everything that we do, whether it's in the physical home, the household, the family, in the congregation, in the church at large. Because look at the way it's going to be very soon now in the kingdom of God. God's kingdom starts in your home, in your family. You see it in the church today, in embryo. That family, that God family of the wonderful world tomorrow, it's here, even today, in the form of God's true church. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us some emails as the week unfolds. As I said earlier, those comments can come to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.